is tape number one, the afternoon of October the 7th. President, no eyes, helmet, president.
Mr. President, would you, at this point, give us your idea of what determines the effectiveness of a president in the office?
Well, the thing I think that determines the effectiveness of a president are conditions as they are domestically and in foreign affairs. And the other, the most important thing that determines whether a president is a president or not is his ability to have ideas for the welfare and benefit of the country.
You were discussing, defining the opportunities for a president to become effective and also his capacity for effectiveness.
He must also have ideas and imagination as to what is for the welfare and benefit of the country. He can create conditions which will make him great, or he can take things as they are and do nothing. We've had a great many presidents like that, Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan and Millard Fillmore and Calvin Coolidge in our own day is the nearest one of the presidents who has been a do-nothing, sit-still president. All the presidents were not of the caliber that the five or six really great ones were, but most of the presidents did things that were for the welfare and benefit of the country, and a great many of the things came out of their own imaginations.
Well, would you rate them as great, mediocre, and poor? Or?
Well, the best rating would be to make them great, and near great, and do nothing.
Now, a do-nothing president is pretty much of a disaster in view of the fact that he occupies a valuable slot in point of history, 4 to 8 years. Now, that's time lost, and some generations have to pay for that.
Well, in the general run of things, that's true. In the present situation, the past 8 years, I think, has been almost entirely lost because the president felt that he was a kind of a monarch who should be above everything that happened in the world and in the country. And that's been bad, not only for the presidency, but it's been bad for the country and the world.
Well, were there any other presidents who took a detached, aloof attitude from the country as president?
James Buchanan was one of them, I think, who was the most outstanding one, and he came just before the Civil War. I think he was the most outstanding one in his time for that sort of an attitude. Benjamin Harrison was that sort of a president. And I think also we'll find as we go into the situation that Rutherford B. Hayes was almost that sort of a president, although he lived in turbulent times and was charged with having gone in on a stolen election. Which we'll go into some detail on when we get around to it.
Well, now, would you have some idea of what was the relationship of the presidents during Monroe's time who were living out their lives, who had been in the office of presidents, or the predecessors? There were three presidents alive during this period, were there not? Three former presidents?
Yes.
Madison was alive?
There were four of them. There was John Adams, James Madison, and James Monroe were all alive at the same time. Jefferson and John Adams died in the middle 1820s. And then Monroe, Madison, and John Quincy Adams lived for some time after that. I don't know.
We're just getting to John Quincy Adams
that's
now.
That's correct.
Were they called in or consulted with, or did they have any part at all in the running of the country?
I don't think they were consulted at all. I can't find any record where they were.
Well, Was this of their own choice, or was it because the presidents who succeeded them?
The presidents didn't want to talk to them. The presidents who were in office didn't care about talking to them. They wanted to be presidents on their own hook, not have a former president around to give them any advice. I think that was their attitude.
This is also your own opinion.
That's just an opinion of mine, yes.
And in light of your experience in the presidency, that is pretty natural manner of behavior for the president that preceded you.
And those who followed also. It's customary for the president, after he's elected, to become the chief executive, and he wants to run things himself. And he wants advisors, he usually wants to pick them out himself and then decide whether he wants to use their advice or not.
Well, you don't exactly approve of that procedure personally, because you didn't practice it when you were in office.
No, I didn't. I was very careful to get all the information I possibly could from people in whom I had the utmost confidence, and it was my privilege to ask the advice of a former president of the United States in an effort to keep people around the world from starving. Did a wonderful job in doing that.
The former president, whom his own party had more or less disowned.
Well, they passed him up. I don't know whether they disowned him or not. They always had him at every convention that they had, but I don't think they gave him any consideration as a president. At least he's only had a chance with one Republican president since he went out of office, and I know that one hasn't given him much consideration.
Would you know why, sir?
For the same reason that the other presidents were the same way to the living presidents. At that time, there were five presidents alive in 1860, and an effort was made to get those five presidents together, five former presidents together, and four of them came to Washington for the purpose of discussing the situation that the country was then faced with, but Martin Van Buren wouldn't come. Nobody knows why, and then the conference broke up.
All right, can we now go to John Quincy Adams, who is the son, only son of a president who occupied the White House.
Yes, sir, he was the son of John Adams, and he was a very well-educated and a very conscientious man. He did a great many things that were of benefit to the country. I think that the Spanish territory in Florida was purchased during his administration as president, if I'm not mistaken. And he was responsible for sending Andrew Jackson down there as the man to take over the territory of Florida, which was successfully done without any serious difficulties to anyone concerned. Then John Quincy Adams' outstanding position in the history of the country is the fact that he went back to Massachusetts after he could not have a second term in the White House, was elected to the House of Representatives, and stayed there for 17 years. And he also wrote a diary covering the periods in which he served. And some parts of that diary have been published. All of it has not been published. And it is now hoped that it will be published, because the Adams family has turned over all the papers of the two Adamses to Harvard University to be indexed in microfilm. We have a first set of microfilms of those papers that have been finished here in this library.
Presently, latter-day historians have paid a good deal of attention to John Quincy Adams as having been one of the great architects of American foreign policy. What is your view of that?
Well, he had a great deal of experience in foreign policy, because he was in the Foreign Service almost up to the time when he became president. I think he was James Monroe's Secretary of State, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And his familiarity with foreign affairs was one of the reasons why he was nominated for president by the House of Representatives. That is, he was elected president by the House of Representatives.
Yes, and he was elected president, as you stated before, as a result of what was thought to be a deal with Henry Clay.
That's what the charge was. Andrew Jackson made the charge that he and Clay had made a deal.
And Henry Clay became Secretary of State.
Henry Clay then became Secretary of State.
And that pushed Jackson to the background.
That pushed Jackson out as the candidate who had received the largest number of electoral votes in the election, which had to go into the House of Representatives. And then in at the end of that term, in 1827, I think it was, Jackson ran again for president against John Quincy Adams and was elected, overwhelmingly elected. And he served two terms from 1828 to, I guess it was 1828 when he was elected. He served then from 1829 to 1837.
Perhaps you'd like to refresh your memory later about the contributions that Quincy Adams made to foreign affairs, because I'm impressed by some of the books which have been written by recent historians and recent professors of history in university.
There isn't a doubt that he made a contribution, but you must understand that the history period of that period has been written mostly by the Adams family, and that's the reason all these things are coming out on the subject.
And then most of these historians recently who have said he's been a great contributor to the making of foreign policy have been New England historians.
That's right, they're New England historians.
Men at Yale.
They had a right to their prejudices, and you can take what they have to say and study it and compare it with what actually happened and make up our own minds as to whether John Quincy Adams was as great in foreign affairs as they say he was.
Well, he was vice president under his predecessor, was he not, John Quincy Adams?
Secretary of State.
He never got to be vice president.
He wasn't vice president, no. He was Secretary of State.
And he ran against Monroe and was very badly beaten. He was at that time.
I don't remember.
Described as the most badly beaten to that time. He only had one vote when he ran against electoral vote.
That was in the so-called era of good feeling.
are inclined to limit the presidency of John Quincy Adams to a rather unproductive reform.
Yes, I think that's true. With the exception of the annexation of Florida, I don't think there was any other event in his administration that was very upset.
Well, that had already begun under Monroe, though, did it not?
Yes, I think it had begun. The negotiations had been made under Monroe, but they were not consummated, I'm sure, until John Quincy Adams became president.
The major contribution towards the conquest of Florida, before we negotiated with the Spaniard, was by Andrew Jackson.
That's true.
Now, I think we're about through, unless you have something more on. We want to go to the president's character now.
Yes. May I, Mr. President, before you we switch to another tape, just I can read this assuring of it in summary. It was second quarter of the 19th upheaval, by a Democratic upheaval, of which Andrew Jackson was a central second, and which was revolution. And American was only political. It was not only social, but also humanitarian, intellectual. In its first in foreign stages, matters of England Southern, led by popular laborers, led by politicians, broadened, took advantage of a broadened suffrage, promoted campaign for two presidencies to the presidency, and later supported his chosen successor, Martin Van Buren. If you'll let me switch to another tape. This is the end of tape number one. This is tape two, the afternoon of October the 7th. Now, with reference to that paragraph that I read, Mr. President, what's your opinion about that?
Well, Andrew Jackson was a very popular figure all over the country. And when Jackson was at the height of his career as a candidate for president, his winning of the Battle of New Orleans was one of the great things that created a situation so he could be elected. But conditions were such that Pennsylvania and New York, as well as the West and the Southwest, were strongly for Jackson because they thought he was interested in the welfare of the little man, that is, the small farmer and the small businessman, and he was. And they also thought he was interested in trying his best to get the finances of the government of the United States centered in Washington instead of in the hands of the Biddles in Philadelphia?
Well, coming of Jackson was the beginning of a, what some call the Age of Jackson, but it was a new era in the history of the United States.
Well, it was a return to a real Jeffersonian democracy when Jackson came into power. Jackson was a great admirer of Thomas Jefferson, and he thought that Jefferson's idea that the everyday man ought to have a hand in the government was the right thing, and that's what he tried to do.
But in defeating, in that campaign when he defeated John Quincy Adams, against whom he ran, there was a tremendous amount of scurrilous stuff said about both of them. Both sides resorted to a great deal of abuse.
Well, that is particularly true with regard to Jackson. I don't think there was so much of it with regard to John Quincy Adams. You see, the times had become such that the special privileged people were in complete control of the government under John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay. They were both economic royalists, if you want to put it that way.
Yes, but Adams referred to Jackson as a man who was not only illiterate, but a man uncouth, and he used a great many abusive words personally against him and wrote about it.
That's true. That was carried on against Jackson nearly all the time while he was president of the United States. But they didn't get too personal because they knew the old man would shoot him if they got too personal.
But here we have a period in which popular choice was being made for the first time, because we had conventions now in instituted for the first time.
That's true.
And you had a man of experience and culture on the one side, and a rough, tough, and in some respects, untutored man running against him.
Well, that's what they always say about Jackson, but you must remember that Jackson had been a United States Senator, he'd been governor of Tennessee, he'd been the commanding general of the forces in the West that won the only victory in the War of 1812, even if that was won after the war was over and peace treaty was signed. But Jackson was not the ignoramus that they make him out. He was a very, very well thought of as an authority on law and procedure in Tennessee.
He was a frontier lawyer himself.
Yes, he was a lawyer. I'm not sure that he was an attorney general of Tennessee at one time. He held all these offices, and he wasn't any ignoramus. He knew what he was doing. He was also a great man on racehorses. He knew how to pick a winner in the racehorse.
But he did not have a formal education. He did not go to one of the...
Oh, no, he didn't go to Harvard, he didn't go to Yale, and he didn't go to any of the Ivy colleges, including Princeton, Ivy League colleges. Mm-hmm. He was educated in Tennessee. He was raised in North Carolina. There's been an argument as to whether he was born in North Carolina or South Carolina, which doesn't make any serious difference, although North Carolina claims him because I dedicated the statue to the three presidents that are supposed to have been born in North Carolina.
I think in this connection, it says here, few administrations have had as much internal dissension as afflicted Jackson's during his first term, and no earlier president so aggressively attacked those he regarded as enemies of the best interest of the people. Jackson saw himself as the only man in Washington who was elected by the whole people, therefore he was their chief representative. This view implied that the president, as a national leader, would exert influence on legislation, and such exertion made this the most exciting presidency until Lincoln's day.
I think that's absolutely true. He had in his first administration, he had the gentleman from South Carolina as his vice president, who was diametrically opposed to everything that he stood for. And he was out of office. He was asked one time two of the things he had left undone that he thought he ought to have done. And one of them was that he said he should have hanged John C. Calhoun and shot Henry Clay.
He was introduced the so-called spoil system. He said the effect of Jackson's policy in this matter has been exaggerated as having been a great evil. But there are advantages, as this writer, and interesting large members or large numbers of average undedicated souls in the daily practice of politics by the hope of some gain to themselves.
Well, the situation was such that the operation of the federal government was in the hands of the Federalists and those who had preceded Jackson in office. There had never been much of a turnover in the operation of the government of the United States, and Jackson, being a popularly elected president, had the naturally the opposition of all these job holders, and he felt that he ought to have somebody to help him run the government that was in favor of what he wanted to do, and that's all he was doing. And it was not an overwhelming change. I think that there were only a few hundred of the federal employees that were discharged, and they were in key positions where Jackson felt that they would do his administration harm if he left them there.
In other words, your interpretation of what has been described as the spoil system was that Jackson, in a sense, turned to men that he could rely on to carry out his policies.
Yes, that's true, and you'll find that there have been great many special laws since civil service has been organized, and since the continued service in the federal government has been protected. But to relieve the men who have to make appointments in key positions from the operation of that civil service program. And the reason is that the people who become settled in their offices are of the opinion that they are going to stay there forever and they don't have to cooperate with the executive that's in charge. It's a very hampering thing. The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, is not under the civil service for the simple reason that the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation wants to have the power to hire and fire the people he thinks are efficient to fill the job.
Well, that is not normally a desirable state of affairs.
Not necessarily. No, it isn't. It's a good thing to have a career service, but it must be arranged in such a way that the career service can't run the government, because the president's got to have active support in a policy that he wants to put through.
And therefore, the action that Jackson took was, in a sense, making it
possible. He wanted to make his administration work. He'd been governor of Tennessee, and he knew what it meant to have people favorable to him in places, in positions of trust under him.
So the merit system became really a tenure system, because they gave him tenure without necessarily proving that they had merit.
That's true, and that's the case today. It needs cleaning out every once in a while, and he come along with a strong president, he cleans them out.
Well, Mr. President, Dave suggested talking about the character of Jackson. He said it was somewhat rough and uncouth. What is your picture of Jackson? How did you see
him? Jackson was a plantation owner in Tennessee, just as the Virginians were when they first came to Virginia. He was a man of high standing in his community. He was well thought of by everybody, and his advice was sought, his help was sought by all the people who were his neighbors. They all liked him. He was a good neighbor and a good man, and a great governor of Tennessee, and he was a good senator, but he didn't like the Senate, didn't move fast enough for him.
He had two problems, though. He didn't spell very well, and his syntax was pretty bad,
neither
too, when he wrote.
Neither did George Washington. He couldn't spell, and his syntax wasn't very, very good either. Jefferson's the only highly educated man of that period who understood the English construction as well as we understand it today. Some of us don't understand it today, but Jackson wasn't any more uncouth than the rest of the people of that day.
But he understood what had to be done. He didn't always express it the way some of the literary people hoped he would.
No, that's right. And one of the things about Jackson is that his papers and everything that he wrote himself have never been edited by the New England historians, and that's what the difficulty is. All the rest of those papers that are published have been.
Well, that's very interesting. In other words, was he also a victim of a certain amount of snobbery? Very much so.
But it didn't bother him very much, because Jackson was of the opinion that he was as good as anybody else, and he made stand up. And that's one of the reasons that the Easterners didn't like him. Harvard finally had to give him a degree, because it came to the point where it was necessary that Harvard recognize a man who knew what he was doing and where he was going.
Well, that's interesting, Mr. President. Can you elaborate a little bit more about the papers of Jackson? What has happened to his papers?
They're in the Capitol building at Nashville, Tennessee. And I don't think they've been completely and thoroughly edited or completely gone over and indexed like they should be.
Very interesting.
Is anything planned for the Jackson papers?
The only plan for all of these papers is under the law which has been passed by the Congress to index and microfilm all the presidential papers. That's in the mill right now, but it'll take a long, long time to get it done.
But he left such a powerful imprint on his times that by his deeds we know him, so that his papers can only supply the detail, but the big deeds are pretty well known.
They're
and
pretty
understood.
Well, yes, they're pretty well known, and there have been a great many wonderful books written about Jackson. Some of them are favorable and some of them aren't. Nevertheless, he stands out as one of the great presidents. I remember one of the great things that he did was when they were having a meeting in Washington. It was a political dinner in which Jackson made the statement, and he made his toast, and it almost upset the apple cart, that his toast was to the Federal Union. It must be preserved. That wasn't what they expected from a former governor of Tennessee and a slaveholder.
That was the beginning of an expression that was beginning to get momentum in those days.
Yes, and that expression had its effect when the secession of the states took place. It's always been my opinion that Maryland and West Virginia and Kentucky and Missouri refused to secede because the Andrew Jackson Democrats prevented it.
That's very interesting. Andrew Jackson Democrats were known as, did they have that tagline on them in those days?
Oh yes, they had that title on them all in every one of those states. I can give you a concrete example of how it worked. If my memory serves me correctly, there were 96,000 Kentuckians in the Confederate Army and 94,000 in the Union Army. In Missouri, there were 118,000 Missourians in the Confederate Army and 116,000 in the Federal Army. And then those were the states where families were against family. There's a specific incident in Tennessee where there was a colonel in the Federal Army who had two sons as captains in the Federal Army. And that didn't happen only in the border states. And it was a result of Jackson's idea that the Union ought to be preserved. And that's what Lincoln was trying to do.
Now, did Jackson have this deep compassion for the people out of his own experience? Because he was pretty badly cut up when he was captured as a prisoner. They cut his wrist and cut his head open.
Well, that was during the Revolutionary War.
That's
I think
right.
He was 15 years old. And some British officer tried to make Jackson shine his shoes, and he absolutely him over the head with a saber. Not with the sharp edge of the saber, but it cut his head a little bit, but it also cut his pride, and he never did get over it.
But he hated the British with a violence that was
He hated any person who was trying to press down on the rights and privileges of the ordinary citizen. That's what gave him that idea, I think.
This was the end of tape 2, the afternoon of October the 7th.